that when her husband first was in the army, she'd had to stay home while he had gone down for his training, and she didn't like being away from him. She sort of dreaded the thought of being separated again, but he was going somewhere with the boxing team. The somewhere, Jeff had told Colette, was Russia, not Fort Dix, not Trenton, New Jersey. The team coach, however, informed the CID reinvestigators that no trip to Russia had ever been planned or even discussed. There was nothing scheduled for the Bragg or Army teams regarding Russia, the coach said. The national AAU team had gone to Russia, departing on or about the 1st of February, but I had no conversation with Captain McDonald regarding his desires to go with them, and there was no travel scheduled for the Army team after the national championships in New Jersey. Gradually, Pruitt and Kearns drew closer to the time of the murders. McDonald had said repeatedly that despite having worked a 24-hour shift at Hamlet Hospital and having put in a full day at his office and having then played basketball for an hour, he had not been overtired on the night of Monday, February 16th. The woman whom Colette had driven to class, however, recalled Colette's commenting that Jeff had seemed totally exhausted. She said, "I forget if he was sleeping or laying on the couch when she left, but she said he was really tired because he had worked all night the night before, and then he had to go to work at Fort Bragg all day." Having had, at the most, a half-hour nap on the living room floor before Kimberly had awakened him to watch Laugh In, McDonald had become so revivified during his wife's absence that upon her return, he not only stayed up watching television with her until 11, but even after she went to bed, he stayed up to watch more television, to finish Kiss Me Deadly, and even to wash the dinner dishes at 2 a.m. Like the unexplained sojourn to Texas and the non-existent trip to Russia, this sudden infusion of energy puzzled Pruitt and Kearns. With McDonald no longer willing to talk to them, however, these did not seem matters which they could pursue. Instead, they focused on Colette's child psychology class. Normally, she was not an active participant in class discussions, but on the evening of Monday, February 16th, she posed a question. She raised the question, her friend said, about her youngest child coming into bed with her and her husband in the night. She wondered whether they should allow the little girl to stay the night, or if they should put her back to bed, or what kind of solution they should try. "It seems to me," she said, "her husband felt that the little girl should stay in bed with him and, you know, that she should go and sleep on the couch." Another member of the class recalled that Mrs. McDonald outlined the situation as one in which a little girl crawls in bed with her parents and pushes her mother out of bed. This was done by the child crowding the mother so far to the edge of the bed that she was no longer comfortable. The instructor asked Mrs. McDonald if it was her child. She replied that it was. The instructor then asked if the child knew that Mrs. McDonald was pregnant. She said yes. The instructor then asked the child's age. I think she told him 2 or 3. The instructor then asked what she did about the child. Mrs. McDonald told him that she had to go to sleep on the couch. The instructor asked Mrs. McDonald what her husband thought of her sleeping on the couch. She replied that it was her husband's decision that the child stay in their bed and that she sleep on the couch. The instructor asked how often this happened. Mrs. McDonald said, "A few times in the last 2 months." There was a general discussion about the problem, and the consensus was that, after a short time, the child should be taken to its own bed and made to understand that that's where it belonged. I remember Mrs. McDonald sitting there smiling and nodding, apparently happy with the decision of the class. It was about this time that class ended. About 5 minutes later, I saw her at the Chopette. The next day, I learned that she and her two children had been killed. Colette had begun the course at the North Carolina State University Extension at Fort Bragg on February 4th. A course not in something literature, as Jeffrey McDonald had told the CID when first asked and had repeated to the psychiatrist Dr. Sadoff, but a course in child psychology, designed to give a basic overview of the relationship between childhood event and adult behavior. Pruitt and Kearns looked closely at Colette's class notebook. On her first night, she had made notes concerning two basic personality types. Sadistic authoritative, the personality that wants to make other person his dependent, and passive dependent, relinquishes self-esteem to the other person. The class met again 4 days later to consider the oral, anal, and phallic stages of pregenital development, in which the libido, Colette noted, was all directed toward self, narcissistic, creating a megalomaniacal attitude in the child, who believed himself to be omnipotent. Eventually, the normal child would pass beyond this stage to the point where ego develops as some libido energy is directed toward other people. A note on ways of coping with anxiety, such as regression, wherein the individual reverts to more infantile behavior, was followed by a description of the phallic stage in the 3 to 4-year-old male. A. Identification with father up to this point. B. At this point, father becomes a rival. C. Little boy wants mommy all to himself. D. Oedipus complex. Kill father, marry mother. E. Castration fear that father will take away his penis. F. This stage seems to set the stage for determination of homosexual or not. Can he identify with father or not? Most critical period of life for child. Whether Colette might have come home from these classes eager to share with her husband some of the new knowledge she was acquiring could only be grounds for speculation. But the possibility that at least some portion of the final few hours of her life had been devoted to conversation with the man suspected of having killed her about either a specific problem concerning one of her children, or the more general subject of the psychosexual development of the human being, caused her notes from Monday, February 16th, to be read with particular care. The class had begun with a continuation of the earlier discussion of human defense mechanisms, such as fixation on earlier stage of development, insulation, withdrawal into a shell of passivity and isolation, compensation, covering up of weakness by overcompensating in another area, and acting out, reducing anxiety concerning forbidden desires by allowing their expression. Colette had written that such defense mechanisms were denials, distortions or falsifications of reality, and functions which occur in the ego's attempt to deal with infantile anxieties, and that they always operate unconsciously. There were later notes under the heading Psychosexual Development and Psychopathology, including a paraphrase of Theodore Reich's description of the father in Western society as one, Colette wrote, who feels unconscious guilt for impregnating his wife, and also unconsciously wants her to go through the pains of childbearing. He goes through the tortures of hell when she is in labor to punish himself for these feelings. The last words she would ever write dealt with psychological disorders which manifested themselves in the genital stage of development. Her final notes included references to such categories as obsessive-compulsive, obsessive collecting or neatness, melancholic, feel guilty about aggressive impulses, paranoid schizo, have high IQ, manic megalomaniacal psychotic, everyone likes them, they think, the world is great, very busy, hyperactive. Then she bought some milk for the morning and went home. As they pressed forward, Pruitt and Kearns turned up a hitherto undisclosed fact regarding Jeffrey McDonald's conduct after the crimes. During the Article 32 hearing, as he'd stood accused of the murder of his wife and children, McDonald, while confined to bachelor officers' quarters, had entered into a sexual relationship with Bonnie Wood, a young civilian woman employed at Fort Bragg. Aware of who he was, as was virtually everyone else at Fort Bragg, she had frequently seen him sunning himself on his front porch during lunch breaks. One day she offered him a tuna fish sandwich and sat with him in the sun. Soon, he was able to persuade the MPs assigned to guard his quarters to permit her access to his room. When questioned, Miss Wood said she had been frankly attracted to MacDonald. "He's handsome, he has a great body, and he was the most exciting thing around." She said she had visited him in his room throughout the summer and fall, and that the relationship certainly wasn't a secret. After the charges against him were dropped, she said, he even took her out to dinner once, double dating with one of his former escort officers. "Probably," she said, "if you had asked me at the time, I would have said I was in love with him." She said she could not recall specifically how many times they'd had sex, but that it was more than once and less than dozens of times. Other than being a violation of the terms of his restriction, this conduct could not be construed as criminal on MacDonald's part, but to Pruitt and Kearns, given the circumstances, it did indicate a certain lack of sensitivity. The reinvestigation, of course, involved more than just character evaluation. The physical evidence, which had from the start been at the core of the case against MacDonald, but which, in Colonel Rock's opinion, had been insufficient to bring him to court-martial, was thoroughly reevaluated, and the quest for new evidence was renewed. William Ivory lay on the floor beneath Kimberly MacDonald's bed within the still-sealed premises of 544 Castle Drive. As he looked up at the underside of the mattress, he noticed that it was supported by slats. He removed the slats and sent them to the CID laboratory at Fort Gordon, where a microscopic examination of the wood proved conclusively that the club used in the murder of Colette and Kimberly had been sawed from one end of a piece of wood that had been used to make one of the mattress slats. Pruitt and Kearns sent other portions of the physical evidence to the FBI laboratory in Washington. Paul Stombaugh, chief of the chemistry division, put Jeffrey MacDonald's blue pajama top under a microscope. He examined the ice pick holes in the garment. Altogether, there were 48. Each was cylindrical and smooth-edged. To Stombaugh, this indicated that the holes had been made while the pajama top was stationary. There were no ragged edges, and none of the tearing that would have resulted had the ice pick been thrust through the garment while it was in motion, as it would have been if it had been wrapped around the wrists of a man who was using it as a shield to ward off thrusts from an ice pick during a struggle. Stombaugh also discovered that the two paring knives, the Geneva forge knife with the bent blade that had been found on the master bedroom floor, and that MacDonald had said he'd removed from his wife's chest, and the old hickory knife with the straight blade that had been found next to the ice pick under the bush 20 feet from the back door, made distinctly different types of cuts in fabric. The blade of the Geneva forge knife was dull and made ragged cuts. The blade of the old hickory knife was sharp and made smooth, clean cuts. Microscopic examination of the cuts in the clothing worn by Colette, Kimberly, and Kristen MacDonald, as well as a study of the autopsy photographs which showed the knife wounds in the bodies, proved, to Stombaugh's satisfaction, that all three victims had been stabbed with the old hickory knife, and none with the Geneva forge knife. In other words, the knife Jeffrey MacDonald claimed to have removed from the chest of his wife had never been in her chest. The only cuts consistent with the blade of the Geneva forge knife were those in MacDonald's own pajama top, leading Pruitt and Kearns to deduce that MacDonald might have used that knife to inflict at least the superficial wounds on himself, and that he had then fabricated the story of removing it from his wife's chest in case his fingerprints were found on the handle. As for the wound which had caused the partial collapse of MacDonald's right lung, this was consistent with the type of cut that could have been made by one of the many disposable scalpel blades which MacDonald had kept in his medical supply closet just outside the hall bathroom, the bathroom in which drops of his blood were found on the right side of the sink. But it was Paul Stombaugh's third finding which was the most significant of all, the single piece of circumstantial evidence which in 1971 most clearly seemed to contradict the story or stories that Jeffrey MacDonald had told. When Stambaugh realigned the sections of the torn blue pajama top to restore it to its original shape, certain of the bloodstains on the garment, stains made with type A blood of Colette MacDonald, formed a perfect, contiguous whole. To Stambaugh and to Pruitt and Kearns, this proved that at least some of Colette MacDonald's blood had been on her husband's pajama top before it was torn. This could not have happened if the top had been torn either during MacDonald's struggle with four intruders in the living room or when he had removed it from his wrists after discovering his wife's bloody body on the master bedroom floor. It could have occurred, however, if MacDonald, while wearing the still untorn blue pajama top, had struck his wife, perhaps during an altercation in the master bedroom, causing her blood to stain it before she reached out in anger or self-defense or some combination of the two and ripped the garment down the front, tearing loose the pocket and showering the rug with dozens of fibers. As the fight had worsened, the pajama top could have become more heavily stained with Colette's blood, and it could have been to account for the presence of her blood in such quantity on his pajama top that MacDonald had laid it across her bloody chest prior to the arrival of the military police at 544 Castle Drive. By the middle of March 1971, Pruitt and Kearns began to receive support from a source they considered almost as unlikely as MacDonald himself, his father-in-law and staunchest defender, Freddie Kassab. Upon receiving his copy of the Article 32 transcript in early February, Kassab had been transformed. The transcript became for him a universe. At times, he seemed its sole inhabitant. He read by day. He read by night. He read with the pure and ferocious attention that a biblical scholar might bring to a first encounter with the Dead Sea Scrolls. For a full month, he did little but read. As he read, Kassab began to underline, then to make notes in the margin. Most of these notes were on the pages containing Jeffrey MacDonald's testimony. By mid-March, Kassab had read these pages a dozen times. His marginal notes had spilled beyond the borders of the transcript and had grown into lists compiled on separate sheets of paper. Lists of inconsistencies, of contradictions, of elements of MacDonald's story which Kassab either knew from direct experience to be false or which, simply as a matter of logic, he found impossible to believe. He then went back to the beginning and drew up an indexed summary of every statement contained in the 153 pages of MacDonald's testimony. Next to each which he disputed, he made a note. Page 8. He volunteered to go into the army. Jeff told Colette he had been drafted. Page 24. He got a blanket and went to sleep in the living room. Jeff normally slept with a pillow. Why did he not have one on the living room couch? Page 25. He heard Colette scream, then say, "Help, help, Jeff. Why are they doing this to me?" and then repeated it at least once. Colette could not have cried out after the severe stab wounds to her neck. The trachea was cut. Page 26. He heard Kimmy screaming, "Daddy, Daddy," over and over. Going on the assumption that Colette and the children were attacked first, Kimmy sustained several severe skull fractures, and according to medical testimony, these were inflicted prior to the knife wounds. It would have been impossible for her to cry out, as Jeff says she did, after the massive blow which caused the severe skull fracture. Also, at the time he says he heard her cry out, the club with which she was attacked was in the living room. Page 29. He says he literally saw stars and was knocked back flat on the couch. He felt like he was blacking out. The account of this first blow with the club would certainly lead one to believe that Jeff was temporarily stunned. If so, why did the assailants not pounce on him? Why wait for him to recuperate and start to sit up again? Also, the blunt trauma wounds to Colette and Kimmy were very severe, yet Jeff received only a slight blow to the forehead, in spite of the fact that he had just come out of a sound sleep and was in a semi-sitting position. Page 30. He described a rain of blows on his head, neck, and shoulders. Yet he received only one wound that was over 1/4 inch deep. It is very strange that Jeff did not receive any knife wounds to his head, neck, and shoulders, since his attackers were standing over him, swinging. Also, a person cannot be stabbed 10 to 12 times in the abdomen while in a seated position, and especially leaning forward, if the person stabbing him is standing. Furthermore, not one drop of his blood was found in the living room from any of the approximately 23 incised wounds he claims to have sustained. Also, with the profusion of blood in those bedrooms, if there were assailants, they would have gotten much blood on their hands and clothing. Why then was there no blood in the living room where the struggle was supposed to have occurred? Page 31. During the struggle, his hands were bound up in the pajama top. How did the pajama top get pulled over his head or torn from the back so that it would end up around his arms and hands when there was no one behind him, and when the pajama top was torn down the front? Page 38. From master bedroom he went to Kim's room. He did not put lights on. Why would a father, especially a doctor, going into a room where his child was so brutally injured, not put the lights on to try to treat her? He could see her chest and neck. How could he when she was covered to the neck with a blanket? He stopped mouth-to-mouth breathing because air was coming out of her chest. Kim had no chest wounds. Also, how did Kimmy's blood get on Jeff's PJ top, since he did not have it on when he examined her in her bedroom? And why were both children found lying on their sides if Jeff gave them mouth-to-mouth? Page 51. He claims 4 blunt trauma injuries to his head. The doctor who examined his head saw only the 1 contusion over his left eyebrow. That is the only one I saw at the hospital at approximately 2 p.m. Page 83. He thinks he wore gloves to wash dishes. To the best of my memory, I have never seen Jeff wash a dish. Even if he did, he is not the type who would put on rubber gloves to do them. Page 84. He gave Kristen a bottle. She cried while Johnny Carson was on. He turned set down when he heard her crying. Why didn't Colette hear her? On page 90, he says Colette, not he, responded to cries from children 95% of time. Why not this time, especially since Chris cried loud enough for him to hear over TV? Page 104. His description of his exact position on hall floor upon regaining consciousness is remarkable. Also, how do you fall up the stairs and around a corner? Also, there was no blood found on floor. Also, the attackers did not panic and run after attacking Jeff. They carried Kimmy back to her room in a sheet, put her in bed, covered her up, then took the sheet back to the master bedroom. They even took the time to write on the headboard. Why then was the attack on Jeff not more severe? Why was he not reattacked as he lay on the hall floor? Page 121. He said he was at the kitchen sink either before or after he used the kitchen phone. If it was before, why was no blood found in the sink? If after, why was there no blood on the phone? Page 124. He didn't call the neighbors for help because I didn't know them that well. How well does one have to know someone to call for help when your whole family has been murdered? Besides, he knew them well enough to invite them for cocktails when we visited at Christmas. Page 140. Denies ever seeing the ice pick and says it couldn't have come from his kitchen. Mildred saw an ice pick and used it during our Christmas visit. On a new sheet of paper, Kassab began to jot additional questions and notes as they occurred, often in the middle of the night as he lay awake, going over in his mind what he had read. One knife and the ice pick were found side by side just outside the back door, and the club just a few feet away. Assailants running from the scene of a crime could not all together at one time in the same place drop their weapons. The rubber gloves that were used were never found except for a few small pieces. They were either flushed down the toilet or taken away. Why would the assailants do this if they left their weapons behind? How did Kim's blood get on the bath mat that was covering Colette? Jeff's blood on the kitchen floor is very odd, since some time passed between the attack on him and the time he went into the kitchen. It was proven conclusively that Kimmy was first attacked in her mother's bedroom, which means she heard her mother scream, woke up, and ran into the bedroom. Why then did Jeff not hear Colette's screams when his head and the sofa were only a few feet from Kimmy's head? With a minimum of six persons, Colette, Kim, and four assailants, fighting in the master bedroom in the dark, how is it that nothing is disturbed? It was no single thing. It was everything. By the third week of March, against his will, for, given the spontaneity and consistency of his support, what could he have been less willing to believe? Freddy Kassab, like Grebner and Ivory and Shaw a year earlier, and now Pruitt and Kearns as well, began to understand why Jeffrey MacDonald was a suspect. He began to see why MacDonald had been accused. He began even to think the unthinkable, that for all its mistakes, the CID might have been right, and he, in his blind faith and ignorance, might have been as wrong as a man can be. Kassab placed a call to Colonel Pruitt. He described the doubts, the torments, caused by his study of the transcript. He said there were two things he would like to do. First, he wanted to travel to Fayetteville to check for himself every newspaper file, hospital record, and police report that might support Jeffrey MacDonald's claim that on Friday, November 16, 1970, he had participated in the killing of one of the people responsible for the murder of his family. Second, Kassab said, he wanted access to the MacDonald apartment. In the company of authorized investigators, he wanted to test for himself the words of Jeffrey MacDonald against the physical reality of 544 Castle Drive. Kassab flew to Fayetteville on March 27th. He was met by Pruitt and Kearns. On the first day, they established to their own satisfaction, through a check of police and hospital records, that neither Jeffrey MacDonald nor any of his Green Beret friends had killed a young white hippie without a mustache, or anyone else, anywhere in Cumberland County, North Carolina, at any time during November of 1970. On the second day, they went into the apartment. 13 months earlier, Freddy Kassab had sat alone in the driver's seat of Jeffrey MacDonald's white convertible, staring at the exterior of 544 Castle Drive, watching a neighbor come out to the front steps in his pajamas to pick up his Sunday newspaper. He now stepped through the front door for the first time since Christmas of 1969. As a crime scene under continuing investigation, the premises had remained sealed. Kassab was not maudlin. He did not express horror. He did not display symptoms of grief. Those responses were by now months behind him. He was at Fort Bragg, he felt, as a technician, with certain tasks to perform. All day, Kassab made measurements. He took notes. He paced off distances, referring again and again to the lists he had brought with him, and to photographs of the crime scene provided by Pruitt and Kearns, refusing to look at only those which depicted the bodies still in place, and to the copy of Jeffrey MacDonald's Article 32 testimony, which he kept securely tucked under his arm. The club used in the murders was 31 inches long. Kassab was 5'10", the same height as the black intruder MacDonald had described. Standing between the coffee table and the couch, Kassab tried to raise a 31-inch stick over his head, as MacDonald had said the intruder had done with the club. It was not possible. The living room ceiling was too low. MacDonald had said that between 3:40 and 3:42 a.m. on February 17, 1970, between his first and second phone calls, in other words, he had looked out the back door in an attempt to detect any signs of the intruders, had gone to the hall bathroom to check his own wounds and wash his hands, had looked into the hall closet for medical supplies, had returned to the master bedroom to check his wife again for signs of life, had administered mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and had checked for pulses at various points on the bodies of both his daughters, and had then, possibly even crawling for a time, gone to the kitchen, possibly even washing his hands again at the kitchen sink. Kassab first walked through, then walked through more quickly, then ran through the actions MacDonald had said he'd performed. No matter how cursory the checks for signs of life, no matter how perfunctory the look out the back door and the washing of hands, it was not possible. No one could have performed those functions within a 2-minute time span. In the afternoon, Kassab went upstairs. With the permission of the current tenants, he lay on a bed in what had been the bedroom of the 16-year-old babysitter, directly above the MacDonald living room. Pruitt and Kearns carried on a conversation in normal tones. Kassab could clearly hear the sounds. How likely, then, was it that a 16-year-old girl would have remained asleep through the sounds of a struggle between a Green Beret officer and at least 4 intruders, in which the officer was wounded 23 times by club, knife, and ice pick? No more likely, Kassab believed, than it would have been for greeting cards on the dining area table to have remained standing through it all. As he stood on the steps that led from the hallway to the living room, Kassab stamped his foot. Greeting cards on the table fell down. In the evening, Kassab went with Pruitt and Kearns to eat dinner at the Fort Bragg Officers Club. Then the three men returned to the apartment. Some of his work, Kassab knew, could only be done in the dark. He turned on lights only in the kitchen and hall bathroom. According to MacDonald, these had been the only 2 lights lit at the time of the attack. Kassab then lay down on the couch. His head was toward the front door, and his feet were toward the hall, just as MacDonald's would have been. Pruitt and Kearns stood above him, crowding between the couch and coffee table. Kassab looked up. Wide awake and already well acquainted with the 2 men, he could scarcely tell who they were. In that light, Jeffrey MacDonald, who needed glasses to read or drive a car, and would have been just emerging from sound sleep, could not possibly have seen sergeant stripes on the sleeve of a black man's jacket, or a mustache on a white man's upper lip, or the glint of a blade, or the color of boots, or a flash of knee, or the color or length of anyone's hair. Next, Kassab stood in the doorway to Kristen's bedroom. Except for the section of floor that had been removed in a futile attempt to preserve the bloody footprint, and except for the absence of the bloody sheets, the room was exactly as it had been when the 2-year-old girl had bled to death from stab wounds in her heart on February 17, 1970. The room was dark, absolutely dark. It received no illumination whatsoever from the light in the hall bathroom adjacent to it. Jeffrey MacDonald could not have stood in this doorway with this room in darkness and seen his younger daughter on the bed, covered in blood. Yet MacDonald had insisted, against all logic, that he had not turned on the light. Kassab thought he now understood why. By his own account, MacDonald's hands would have been covered with blood as he had entered this room. He already had handled the bodies of Colette and Kimberly, and he had not yet gone to the bathroom to wash. But no blood had been found near the light switch. In reconstructing a story which would fit the physical evidence as he had then understood it, MacDonald had had no choice but to say that he had allowed the room to remain in darkness. Freddie Kassab stepped to the edge of the bed in which Kristen MacDonald had died. He leaned over, just as Jeffrey MacDonald had said he leaned over, in order to administer mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Kassab still could see almost nothing. just as in The Darkness, 13 months earlier, Jeffrey MacDonald could not have seen blood bubbling from his younger daughter's chest. Kassab remained in the apartment until midnight. By the time he emerged, he was not only thinking the unthinkable, he was convinced. With the conviction, there came a strange, icy calm. At last, Kassab knew who his enemy was. The anguish, rage, and frustration that had consumed him for more than a year began to fuse into a new and quite different emotion, a commitment so powerful, so concentrated, that its essence would sustain him for the next decade and more, as he carried forward a single-minded, obsessive, and often solitary crusade to see Jeffrey MacDonald convicted of murder and imprisoned. "It won't be easy," Pruitt told him as they stood on the front steps of 544 Castle Drive. It was, Pruitt explained, an entirely circumstantial case, and to make it more difficult, serious mistakes, as Kassab was well aware, had been made in the original investigation. The Army's own investigating officer had found the charges to be not even worthy of presentation at court-martial. With Jeffrey MacDonald now a civilian, a new prosecution could be initiated only by the Justice Department, which, given the complexity of the case and the time that had already elapsed and the mistakes that had already been made, was not likely to give the matter a high priority. There was too much chance for failure, too little chance for success, no matter how persuasive Pruitt's evidence might prove to be. "It could be a long haul," the CID colonel said. "That's all right," Kassab said, staring into the darkness. "I'm only 52 years old. Besides, I've got the patience of Job." Chapter 4. To Mildred Kassab, the shock that accompanied her acceptance of the probability that Jeffrey MacDonald had killed her daughter and grandchildren was not much less devastating than the initial trauma of their deaths. At first, she had not wanted to listen to her husband when he had begun to speak of his suspicions. She had been through so much already, this would be too much to bear. Even when he finally made her listen, she refused to believe. He would show her his underlinings and his marginal notes and his pages of questions and comments. He would sit for hours and attempt to explain what he considered the undeniable logic of it all. But still, Mildred would not allow herself to be convinced. She did, however, recall with an uneasiness that grew slowly into terror the minutes that MacDonald had spent in her kitchen the previous December, glancing nervously about the room as he piled improbable detail upon detail during his recitation of his tale of revenge. Thus, when Fred Kassab called from North Carolina the first time in late March to say that Jeff's story of killing one of the intruders was a lie, Mildred felt herself begin to waver. When he called again the next day, having spent his somber hours inside 544 Castle Drive, to say that the truth was no longer in question, Mildred felt the full horror begin to overtake her. "The first doubts," she wrote in her journal, "the refusal to believe, too awful to contemplate. Colette's love for him and death at his hands, alone with her hurt and pain and keeping it secret, the guilt not to have known her unhappiness, to have been selfishly going about my own affairs while she was alone and fearful. Their last moments, filled with such pain and terror. I said, 'Wait until spring.' With the last blow, he crushed her head like an eggshell." In May, Jeffrey MacDonald took a vacation trip to Barbados. He sent a postcard to Freddie and Mildred Kassab. "It's nice," he wrote. "Great to get out of NYC, but it's lonely." The Kassabs did not reply. In June, having not been offered a residency at the Yale University Medical Center, and having found that his New York celebrity was starting to fade, and aware also that he was a prime suspect in a continuing murder investigation, though this was an awareness which he kept very much to himself, MacDonald moved to California and took a job in the emergency room of St. Mary's Hospital in Long Beach, a job offered by a former Green Beret physician from Fort Bragg. Soon after his arrival, he sent his former in-laws a change of address card. "Super busy," he scrawled at the bottom. "No news. Will write." Once convinced of the Kassab's willingness to accept the results of the reinvestigation, Pruitt and Kearns began to share information with them. The worst day, for Mildred, was the Saturday in June when Pruitt and Kearns arrived at the Kassab home to inform them that Helena Stokely had been effectively eliminated as a suspect. While swimming in the backyard pool that Colette had never seen, Pruitt and Kearns also told the Kassabs of Jeffrey MacDonald's series of infidelities. For Mildred especially, this news carried a special sting. "Because then," she said, "I knew that not only had he killed her, he hadn't even been a decent husband to her while she was alive." Now that they were receptive to information which cast an unflattering light upon their former son-in-law, the Kassabs found that there was no shortage of it about. Most had to do with infidelity. Acquaintances informed them that during the summer of 1964, the first summer after the birth of Kimberly, MacDonald, while spending the week at his construction job on Montauk Point, had engaged in an affair with a secretary at the company by which he was employed. Even more distressing to the Kassabs were stories that MacDonald had maintained a relationship with his former high school girlfriend, Penny Wells, even after his marriage to Colette. Mildred now recalled an evening during June of 1969, just weeks before MacDonald had left for Fort Sam Houston. He and his brother and sister were giving a party to celebrate their mother's 50th birthday, and the Kassabs had stopped by briefly to pay their respects. "Penny Wells had been invited," Mildred wrote in her journal. "Colette pointed her out to me and asked if I thought she was pretty. After we left, all the gifts were piled up, and Jeff's mother asked Penny to open them and read off the cards. Colette stood by, and one of her friends later told me that she later went inside and cried in embarrassment and hurt." An acquaintance told the Kassabs that several months later, Jeff, in full Green Beret uniform, had been observed embracing Penny Wells on the Patchogue train station platform. This was in November of 1969, a time that coincided with MacDonald's emergency home leave. If this were true, and if it were true also, as Pruitt and Kearns found it to be, that by February of 1970, Miss Wells had taken an apartment in New York City, then MacDonald's sudden desire to accompany the Fort Bragg boxing team on its trip, not to Russia, as he had told Colette, though having her think he was incommunicado behind the Iron Curtain would both relieve him of any responsibility for maintaining contact with her and make the venture seem more of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity than would have been a trip to Trenton, New Jersey, but to tournament sites that would have put him within easy striking distance of his old high school flame, became much more understandable. At home, in silence and with even sharper, more insightful pain, Mildred Kassab read and reread the dozens of letters that Colette had written to her. In particular, she focused on the letters Colette had written from Chicago during Jeff's years at medical school, years that had apparently been filled with hope and joy. "Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention it on the phone, but if Freddie really meant it about letting Jeff use his jacket this winter, it would really come in handy, I think. I've spoken to some natives, and they say it gets unbearably cold. Kim's favorite game right now is really adorable. You know the way Jeff and I blow on her stomach and make that sound? Well, she has learned to do it now, too. Not on me, but on Jeff, because he has his shirt off. She stands on his lap and leans down and blows on his chest and makes a little teeny sound and then looks up and laughs. Poor Jeff has so much work. Yesterday he had an exam for which he had been staying up until 4 a.m. every morning. Unfortunately, It was not a hard test the way it was promised to be, and he wasn't able to show what he really knew. "Freddy, I'm really sorry that I didn't get to speak to you on the phone, but wait until we get home for Christmas. You won't be able to shut me up. And wait until Kim sits on your lap and pulls herself up by your ears. That will be only the beginning." As you can guess, things are pretty rough right now, financially. We haven't paid our January rent yet, so Jeff went looking for part-time jobs the other day. I really hate to see him work when he needs the time for studying, but other than money problems, everything is fine. Luckily, our dispositions are still good. I guess because we feel that it isn't always going to be this way. Colette's last letter from Chicago had been written in February of 1968, at the start of her husband's final semester in medical school, and 2 years before she and her children would be murdered. Now that Jeff is almost a doctor, he has to wear his white jacket to class and to the hospital. You should see him. He looks really great. Very handsome and very professional. Tomorrow he gives his first examination to a patient. The patient is told only that a doctor will be in to see him, and Jeff introduces himself as Dr. McDonald and is on his own from there on. Of course, he has been practicing on me for a week, and I have been percussed when they thump you to find out where and how large your organs are and palpated for masses and to find rigidity of muscles, symmetry of the two sides, etc., and auscultated, listened to, until I am sore. I'm really glad I'm not taking classes this semester because it is a full-time job being a patient. Yesterday, we took Kim to the zoo. What an experience. As you can imagine, she was terrifically excited. I got a little worried because she was so excited that she could hardly breathe, and I'm not exaggerating. She spent most of the time sitting on Jeff's shoulders, or I should say, jumping on his shoulders. She was all exclamations and panting and jumping and pointing. We took some bread along with us to feed the animals, and she almost went crazy with delight when she was able to feed the giraffe and the deer. The giraffe was the biggest thrill of all. Jeff held her up, and the giraffe held out her tongue until Kim put it on and then ate it. We took a few pictures of that. Meanwhile, your grandchild Kristen is a devil. As you know, she didn't have any teeth, up until last week when she got two together. We were all up for 3 nights to get her through the trauma. Now she is a toughie and goes growling around the house like a baby panther. She and Kim have been having so much fun playing together lately. They both play peekaboo, and then they roll across the floor trying to catch each other. It's really a great feeling hearing your own kids laughing and having fun with each other. During the summer of 1971, Mildred Kassab became aware of a lump in her breast. She told no one about it and did not seek medical attention, not even when it began to grow. She referred in her journal to her final acceptance of the truth and subsequent desire to just die. Stop hurting. Stop feeling. Hugging my growing cancer to myself, keeping it secret for my release. But then, as she watched her husband grow stronger and more determined day by day, she realized the selfishness of her desire. She came to recognize, she wrote, the need for action and retaliation. Colette had been her only daughter. It seemed not so much to expect of herself that she would assist her husband on his relentless quest for justice. In October, she underwent surgery and began a series of radiation treatments. In November, Jeffrey McDonald returned from California for a brief visit to family and friends. He did not pay a social call on the Kassabs. Since the change of address card, they'd had no communication of any kind with him. Freddie, in particular, had been growing increasingly restive through the fall. Believing what he now believed, and witnessing daily the agonies that his wife was enduring, it galled him immeasurably to think of McDonald as a free man, enjoying the fruits of his new bachelor life in Southern California. Aware that the investigation was still in progress, Kassab had vowed to himself that he would not do or say anything that would indicate prematurely to MacDonald just how much evidence the CID was assembling. But upon learning of the Eastern trip, Kassab was unable to contain his irritation entirely. He broke silence long enough to write MacDonald a letter. "We have just been told by a friend that you were here on Long Island a few weeks ago. If this is so, I think you should be thoroughly ashamed of yourself for not at least calling us on the telephone. For one solid year, we called you almost daily and did everything human beings can do to help you. In return, we received a total of 2 phone calls from you, one to stop me from coming to Fort Bragg to get a copy of the transcript. I have just inquired from both the Army and the FBI and find that you have never asked for any information on the progress of the investigation to find the murderers. Perhaps you would like to push the whole thing behind you. We can't and won't until whoever did this is punished." As vague as that wording was, it seemed to make Jeffrey MacDonald uneasy. His tale of having killed one of the intruders obviously had not sufficed. The Kassabs still were not willing to forget. He replied to Kassab's letter immediately and with considerable indignation. "I am answering your incredibly rude, illogical, and factually wrong letter because I know deep down that the only reason you wrote it was because you did love Colette, Kim, and Christy, and hopefully me, so much. That love would not be apparent from your letter, and I can only hope it is your frustration at not seeing justice done that propels you to write such trash. I was in Long Island several weeks ago for 2 days, half-day traveling to and from airport, half-day at the graves, 1 day with mother, family, supposed friends and relatives. I have been in Long Island on several occasions in the last 3 months, usually not to see my family, but to continue work on finding 3, or possible 4, one more might be added, according to current stories in Hippie Family No. 2 in North Carolina, fugitives. I find I accomplish more when less people know I'm around. I must say, your apparent faith in Army investigators is puzzling, to say the least, when it is apparent to even the most casual observer that, one, usually they are incompetent, if not criminal, in nature, and two, if not incompetent, they are carefully picked to follow the Army line. This is true in every case currently in the public eye, just as it was in our case. They are either incredibly inept or they are out to protect the Army. I have come to my final decision in this matter. To believe anything else is sheer refusal to face facts. I am sorry I didn't call or see you this last visit. I truly tried, but every time I tried to leave my mother's apartment, some other idiot would arrive. I didn't call because I felt you would be annoyed/hurt if I called but didn't have time to come over. If you want me to be blatantly honest, another reason I have hesitated seeing you more frequently is because I live, relive, re-relive the case day and night. I have to consciously try to think of other things to maintain my sanity. At times, free time is almost worse than being guarded in my room. In my room, I would bitch more directly about the Army, but free, I run around in circles, always thinking of the case and trying to do several things at once. I find being with you and Mildred, as the most direct links to Colette, the most painful experience I have, except reviewing my pictures and slides. It destroys me for several days, and I found it better to keep my own defenses up by being alone. I cannot discuss Colette and Kim and Chris easily or well, because they were everything to me. And when I am with you, I find myself trying to do that. Do you see what I am trying to say? As for the FBI and Army, that is an absolute lie that I haven't asked for information. I have been turned down on numerous occasions by both the FBI/CID, including those investigators you liked so well last spring, and Justice Department, for any info on the case. It is obvious the only way for justice to be met is for me to do it. I am doing it, have been doing it, 4 trips to North Carolina and Florida in last 3 months, and will continue to do it as long as my strength holds up. Broken hand last trip, $2,000 spent. The only legit help I foresee is private eye type, most of which I have found is no more competent than local cops. My next major goal is a large sum of money via an advance from a publisher for this purpose. The first chapter of my book has been written, the outline is done, and still we are only dickering with publishers. They just won't come across fast. I would like to push the whole thing behind me. Wouldn't anyone? I'd give anything to wake up and find it all a bad dream and have my life and house filled again with Colette, Kim, and Christy. The only difference between you and I is that I don't think you see the fact that justice will not bring back my family. I want revenge, preferably brutal revenge. I don't care about justice anymore. There is no justice, in case you haven't noticed. You act as though you are on a noble cause. I think the cause is ugly, brutal, but necessary. I will do it. I have done some. 1/4 or 1/5 of it. Don't try to bullshit me about not caring. Our aim is the same. Don't let frustration drive you down. I have been so frustrated at times in the last year, you wouldn't believe it. I'm sorry if this letter is too honest. Just remember it is honest. I care not for people's feelings anymore. If and when revenge becomes complete, I foresee such pain at the full realization that it was all useless, because my 3 girls are not back, that life will not be worthwhile. Meanwhile, try to remember the loss is, for me, at least as great as your loss. The Kassabs had not seen Jeffrey McDonald's mother since April of 1971, when she had come by their house to deliver some slides of Colette and the children which they had requested, and to tell them that Jeff was no longer able to visit the cemetery. It was simply too upsetting for him. Early on the evening of February 15th, 1972, however, she paid them a surprise visit. She brought with her a small floral arrangement and said she had just heard that Mildred had undergone surgery. She was her usual buoyant, bouncy self, Mildred would later recall. You know, hey kid, how are you? You're looking great, that sort of thing. Actually, I looked pretty horrible at the time. The Kassabs offered her a drink, which she accepted. Then Freddie found himself unable to contain his true feelings. He felt compelled, as he put it later, to give her a few facts of life. For the next 2 hours, Kassab explained, in explicit and extensive detail, what it was he had become convinced of, and what it was that had led him to his conclusion, the conclusion being that Dorothy McDonald's son had murdered his own wife and children. She didn't say a word, Kassab recalled later. Not one word. For 2 hours, she just sat there in silence, with that one drink in front of her. She didn't get mad, she didn't get angry, she didn't dispute anything I said, and believe me, I said it all. She just sat there. When I had finished, she stood up and said, "Well, I think I'll go home." That was it. That was the last time we ever spoke to her. Months later, it was in fact in early summer, the Kassabs found notes on the graves of Colette, Kimberly, and Kristen. The notes were in the handwriting of Dorothy McDonald. They said, "Dearest Colette, you were every inch a woman. God forgive me for not telling you this, but I always respected you. All my love, Mom." "Dearest Kim, you were more precious to me than life itself. God keep you from any more pain. I love you. Nana." "Dearest Christy, you were always the toughie. May your spirit endure. Love you. Nana." The Kassabs turned the notes over to Pruitt and Kearns. Eventually, Dorothy McDonald moved to Southern California, where she bought a small house only 10 minutes from her son's condominium. Having pursued leads in 32 states, Vietnam, Okinawa, Germany, the Canal Zone, and Puerto Rico, and having conducted dozens of new tests at the crime scene, and having obtained and analyzed 34 additional